Thank you, Vice Chancellor. It is great to be here. I always love coming back. I've never been into this particular lecture theatre before, and I'm in a part of the university which certainly didn't exist in my time, and not all the names even of the streets are the same as they were when I was here. I should begin by saying perhaps that when the university received its charter in August 1962, it also at the same time got a coat of arms. And the coat of arms bears the words, "Be still and know." And I've never understood how it could conceivably have chosen those words, because I've never been still in my life, and I feel I've got to know quite a lot without having the guidance of the Charter. It goes on, however, to say, which is not quoted in most of the books, "Be still and know that I am God." And that is probably the most important part of the university's motto. I'm going to try to talk tonight on the occasion of the 50th year after the first coming to Sussex of the science undergraduates. I'm going to try to speak about that. And I've been contemplating a lot of the whole story of the development of the sciences as I saw it. I was going to deal with the period from the arrival of the first scientists, science students, in 1962, and go down to the period when arts and science were formally divided in the university's structure in 1967. And two new posts were created, the Pro Vice Chancellor Arts and the Pro Vice Chancellor Science. I had an enormous amount to do with science in the early years of the university, largely but not solely because of my friendship and cooperation with Roger Blinstroyer. He and I worked together with perfect harmony in devising what the university would be. And I owe an immense debt to him for the part that he played before the university was formally divided into arts and science by the McKinsey report, which came at the end of the period. I was going to stop with the McKinsey report tonight, but I realised that in fact I couldn't stop there, because there were certain things that happened after McKinsey which at least should be fitted into a complete picture. I also realised myself that the memories of the McKinsey report are almost non-present in the university at the present time. And I found it very difficult to persuade people inside the university, not you, Vice Chancellor, that there was such a thing as the McKinsey report at all. I'm not going to use notes tonight, I never do, but I'm falling back on just a few bits of paper which are very necessary to me in order to read precisely what was said. I found that I wrote an article, of course, while I was in Australia, before I came to Sussex, on the map of learning. And that article has been reprinted time and time again. But I did get the New Statesman version of the Map of Learning, which was published in on the 3rd of March 1961. And it was called Universities for Tomorrow, Maps of Learning. And in it, I read these words. Since arts studies will start at Brighton on a strictly limited scale in October of this year, while the first science students will not be admitted until 1962, it will be some time before the organisation of the map of learning in the sciences will be determined. Consultation between scientists themselves and between scientists and other scholars is necessary, therefore, before schools of science can be evolved. A search will be made, however, for genuine links between the arts and the sciences, along the same lines that the search is being made within the arts themselves. There are some obvious links, for example, beginning to be a very tattered piece of paper, as nearly all my old papers I've found are. It doesn't make them any worse. Links between geography and earth studies, between social studies and technology, and between history and philosophy on the one hand and science on the other. Moreover, there are mathematical studies which will be relevant to several schools in the whole university. The step-by-step growth of Brighton, it will not start with a large establishment, should make possible the regular informal as well as formal consultation between people involved in teaching science and people teaching other subjects. Now, that particular phrase did not appear in the Australian version of the lecture, which is usually quoted. And I find it's particularly interesting. I didn't know then, however, that already in 1961 and 62, science faculty were being appointed to the university before the first science students arrived. Certainly, mathematics came very early with Bernard Scott, and I should say that I had nothing to do with the appointment of any of these scientists, faculty, science faculty, with the exception of Roger Blinstoyle. And Roger Blinstoyle, rather disappointed by what was happening inside Oxford in those days, Roger Blinstoyle, I approached on Oxford Station. Trains play a big part on stations in the way the University of Sussex has developed, more than step by step. I said to Roger, would you like to come to Sussex? And he said, yes, he would. He doesn't tell the story fully in the book that he himself wrote later on about Sussex opportunity, in which he discusses the various opportunities in different subjects, including his own. Now, Bernard Scott was a most extraordinary person. He could, I think, rightly be described as a little eccentric. Nonetheless, he was deeply devoted to the university, and he had one quality which I admired enormously, which he wrote poetry as well as dealt with mathematical equations. And I've always liked that kind of combination of interests. He appointed quite a sizable number of mathematicians in the year before the first science students arrived. In fact, there were more mathematicians in the first group of science students who arrived than there had been the total number of art students in the days of Preston Road before we moved into this particular campus. I've been deeply grateful to three people in particular in preparing what I'm going to say tonight. One to Douglas Brewer, who was the first scientist that I got to know personally as a friend, apart from Roger, and he was brought to Sussex by Roger. The second person was David Smith, who really has had the remarkable gift of collecting details of the first chemistry professors. Sadly, the same thing was not done for the physics professors. And David's notes have been of great value to me in thinking about what I'm going to say. I also, third person, is Geoffrey Lockwood, who was very, very closely involved with the whole of the McKinsey discussions and who played a very big part behind the scenes in ensuring that the university would get a new structure given its increase in size. Now, given that those debts, I would like to go back again, if I may, to the founding of the science groups, and also to say that, Vice-Chancellor, I discovered a letter which you sent me as long ago as the 20th of December 2007. You'll be pleased to know that we're beginning to turn our thoughts in earnest towards planning for Sussex's 50th anniversary in 2011. I would be very happy indeed if you could have some helpful discussions with the people who are devoting their first thoughts to this subject. That was December 2007. And I then began to think, what would be my contribution to the celebrations of the 50th anniversary of the university? I knew that it coincided with my 90th birthday, and I knew that it was also the 40th anniversary of the first students taking their place in the Open University, which is the second institution to which I've devoted my love and care over the years. My book, Special Relationships, which talks about the beginning of the University of Sussex at some length, was actually launched by the Open University Vice-Chancellor, because sadly, at that particular time, the Vice-Chancellor of Sussex couldn't be present. And this book, Special Relationships, tells the story of the way in which the university developed, never the same, one year to another. Tonight, I've chosen to talk about science because I felt that it should be commemorated in this particular year. I was going to call the lecture to begin with The Origins of Science, because I was deeply involved in the celebrations of Charles Darwin's centenary of his book years before. And the origin of the sciences at Sussex was my original title for this lecture. But it was not entirely easy to persuade the people who were preparing the lecture lists that the word origins of science at Sussex would convey the right impression. Origins of science, however, are what I'm going to talk about. The idea of having science subjects, as I've said, was fundamental and was brought out in the book, in the article in the New Statesman. The way in which each particular science developed is fascinating in itself to pursue. I've come to the conclusion that in the story, the people who worked in the laboratories and the people who worked theoretically in the sciences were drawn closer and closer together. And they all owed an immense amount to the people who were not members of faculty at all, but were really themselves developing the labs and their organisation. I also have learnt that that group of people who were in a ratio of 5 to 4 as against the faculty of the science faculty of the university were themselves deeply keen on the new university that they were serving. A.J.P. Taylor, whom I admire, A.J.P. Taylor once wrote a silly article in the Sunday Express in which he said that at Sussex we were all swilling down port. I'd never had one glass of port in Sussex at that time, and that we were also living on the fat of the land. And I can't say that we were, even in terms of food. Now, the people who wrote to the Sunday Express complaining against this piece were the science people working with the faculty. They were the first to write, and they were furious when the Sunday Express didn't print what they had to say. And they asked me if I would write to A.J.P. Taylor and tell him that the Sunday Express had refused to print their own response. And I did write to A.J.P. Taylor, and I must admit I didn't get much of a response myself. if you look at the way in which the sciences developed, each one has its own history. I've already mentioned mathematics. Physics developed on a very interesting basis, and most of the many physicists were appointed before the first science students arrived. And Douglas Brewer has given me his own account of some of the interesting features of that first recruitment. And I didn't know until then that in 1961, already, the people who had been appointed to be teachers of science were meeting at the Old Ship in Brighton to discuss the nature of the science syllabuses. Therefore, they were active, unpaid as we were before we came, because we were still paid by our own university until we arrived here. They were acting and working closely together, thinking about what the science curriculum would be. Now, from a bit later on in the story, in 1965, when John Murrell arrived in the university, he wrote an admirable little book about the development of molecular sciences in Sussex. And I did feel myself that my debt to him, I must acknowledge, as I've acknowledged my debt to other people. Over the years, I think, John came to realize that what we had been doing in those very first years was crucial and fascinating. The development of the subject, as he and others have pointed out, rested on a change from the original conception of a school of mathematics and physics into a number of science schools. And they produced some very interesting people, some of whom went on to be vice chancellors of other universities. John West, whom I brought to Sussex from Belfast to be first dean of the School of Applied Sciences, really became vice chancellor a bit later on of the University of Bradford. The most important future Vice-Chancellor was John Kingman, Professor of Statistics here, who moved on to become Vice-Chancellor of Bristol via a period of time as Professor of Statistics in Oxford. And he was probably the most distinguished statistician, it was thought, in the country. It was a great privilege to get to know these people in the same way as it was to get to know all the other people who are here tonight who were with me in arts subjects. Now, with Roger Blinstoyle, we worked out what were called tables of logistics. The word logistics, I think, had never been used in a university context before I used it with Roger in those tables. And we plotted the way in which the different science and art subjects would develop. The numbers of students, the numbers of faculty in the first 5 years of the university. They were quite remarkable tables because it was not very common in universities at that time to think so far ahead about how they would develop. And the University Grants Committee, which operated on a quinquennial system, was not particularly interested in the way in which we were developing the University of Sussex. I was a member of the University Grants Committee for quite a long time. And while I was a member, I was appointed in 1959. I remained a member of the University Grants Committee until I became Vice Chancellor here. And there I met a very large number of interesting scientists. I particularly admired, as a scientist, Eric Ashby, to whom I owe a great debt. I thought his little book, Technology and the Academics, was a brilliant book. And he subsequently did his best to become a historian and started producing books about the history of universities. The other person to whom I owed a great debt was Willis Jackson, who was interested in engineering. And I made it my job in the University Grants Committee to take a particular interest in engineering, because I thought that we were teaching engineering appallingly badly in universities at that time. And therefore I took an interest in it, and I talked to Willis Jackson about what we should do here at Sussex. Willis knew that the University Grants Committee, of which we were both members, didn't think that Sussex should have a School of Applied Sciences at all. I spent a lot of time going around the county trying to persuade people that they should give financial support to a School of Applied Sciences in the university. I got no funds at all out of that effort. The local employers were no more interested in the development of a School of Applied Sciences here than the University Grants Committee was. All kinds of ironies come out in all this. I spent a lot of time talking to one man who never came to the University of Sussex at all about the life sciences. Jim Danielli in London would have been my first choice as the Dean of the School of Biological Sciences. But Jim went off to America, where he got a very agreeable post, and it was fortunate because the man who did become the first dean of biological sciences was a really great man, John Maynard Smith. I can't really pay a big enough tribute to John Maynard Smith. He was a really marvellous lecturer. He took an interest in all his students. He insisted on teaching his first year students in the way that people in the arts were teaching their first year students. He established links with other parts of the university, and through him, a totally new school was to come into existence, the School of Cognitive Sciences. That was the result of the work of people in the first years of Sussex getting together in an interdisciplinary way. And the person who, apart from John Maynard Smith, was so important in that respect was another very, very remarkable and very eccentric man, Stuart Sutherland. Stuart, I got to know very well because he would come into my office and tell me, Asa, you must be quite sure of one thing. Never appoint to any professorship anybody who is second rate. In fact, be very careful about appointing any professors of psychology at all. I had fascinating talks with Stuart, and sadly he was seized with terrible depression and is best remembered now, I fear, for what he had to say about depression than he is for what he had to say about cognitive studies. There are ironies, therefore, in the development of the sciences as there are in the development of the arts. I thought that I would end this part of the lecture, as I said, with the McKinsey report. But I realised that I couldn't end there because I would have to say something about my own interest in science throughout the whole of my life. My father was himself involved in what would be called artisan crafts in a very meticulous way. My grandfather, I discovered a very remarkable book when I was preparing this lecture, which belonged to him and which he bought in the year 1872, which is quite interesting, and it's called Introduction to the Sciences. Abraham Briggs was his name. And it's quite amazing what the range of studies in this book is. He says that it includes the science as sciences that he treats: astronomy, natural philosophy, geology and physical geography, meteorology, electricity and magnetism, chemistry, botany, zoology, human physiology, and mental philosophy. And I'm proud to think that my grandfather devoted his time to studying those subjects a long, long time ago. Now, I became interested in science when I was a boy at school, and my best subject when I took what was then called the matriculation examination, was chemistry. And the chemistry master at the school, who was the second master in the school, came round to tell me, before the results were announced, that I had done very well in my matric and that my chemistry mark was outstanding, and begged me to do chemistry in the sixth form. Now, if I'd been living now, I probably would have had to do chemistry. I would have moved in that direction. But fortunately, I didn't. And instead, my headmaster, who ultimately had the last word in all these matters, as I've explained in my book on Bletchley and indeed on my book on the special relationships, my headmaster insisted that I should read history. And he insisted that I should read it in Sidney Sussex College, Cambridge, and not in Oxford, or anywhere else, any other college in Cambridge for that matter. Now, at Sidney Sussex College, Cambridge, as an undergraduate, I got to know two people who became very important during the war. When it was thought possible to be able to convert historians into scientists for the duration of the war. An amazing thought. I was seen by C.P. Snow to decide whether I would be suitable to become a scientist for the war, but curiously enough, it was to be in radar and not in cryptography. Now, I would have been useless in radar, I think, but C.P. Snow thought that I would do it perfectly well. Instead, I moved over to work at Bletchley in cryptography. The science, therefore, came to matter to me a lot during the war. At Bletchley, I worked with people who had no sense of formal hierarchy, who believed that everybody in Bletchley was important, where there were far more women than men, which I greatly approved of. I also brought from Bletchley certain ideas about interdisciplinary work. And those ideas I brought into Sussex in the years before I became Vice-Chancellor. Going on to my own life, I went at the end of the war to the Institute for Advanced Studies in Princeton. And there I met, but I can't say that I had much conversation with Einstein. I also met Oppenheim and had plenty of conversation with him. I had most conversation of all, however, at the Institute with young physicists. I really felt that I could talk to them in a way that I'd never been able to talk to any physicists before. they treated me again as an equal, and they explained all kinds of problems in physics to me. The years that I spent at Princeton were of crucial importance in the way in which I came to think about science. After Princeton, I also learnt a lot about science from people who were involved in the organisation of universities other than my own. And I talked to them at very great length about the subjects that I'm talking about tonight. But I came to the conclusion that I would devote a part of this lecture to the people who have written about the history of science in a way that has influenced me. And the most important of them, undoubtedly, was Herbert Butterfield. Herbert Butterfield was at the same school as me, and Herbert produced, again I've got to get the exact reference, Herbert Forgive me. I'm not used to handling papers in the course of a lecture or books, but they're so important to what I'm saying. Here, as usual, right at the bottom, it is. He wrote a most interesting... He was interested in the history of science before most historians were. And he wrote this piece in 1959, the same year, incidentally, as the centenary of Darwin's Origin of Species, The History of Science and the Study of History. And I was deeply interested in his very first paragraph. Although the world had long known that science and technology were important, it is only recently that these things have taken command of our destiny, that destiny which we had learnt from our history books to regard as depending so greatly on the wills of statesmen. Only very recently indeed have we come to be aware of the degree to which, in the future, science is going to be built into the walls of everybody's mind. He then goes back to some of the ways in which one of the safest speculations that we could make today about any branch of scholarship is that very soon the history of science is going to acquire an importance amongst us incommensurate with anything that it has hitherto possessed. I was going to mention a bit earlier, and it's so fundamental to this subject, that the body that I was most proud of, in a way, in Sussex, was SPRU, the Science Policy Research Unit. It did a wonderful job in those days, and it found a man, I think, of great distinction in Christopher Freeman to run it. Christopher brought to Sprue a sense of the importance of science in the world and a sense of the importance of being able to forecast as well as to look back on history. So there's a combination of Sprue and Butterfield is important. I didn't feel, however, that it would be wise for the history of science to develop in very small departments. I don't like small departments. I don't like departments at all, as I've explained at length in my most recent book. I left Leeds with an immense distaste for departmentalism when I had to sign treaties with the heads of other departments, and the only reason that I could sign them that was because I was a Yorkshireman, and they were prepared to sign treaties with a Yorkshireman but not with anybody else. Sense of place, terribly important. Sprue was very fortunate in not only in Christopher but in some of the other people who have not figured in some of the books that have been written about the university's 50th celebrations. And the one to whom I would like to pay a very special tribute is Roy MacLeod. Roy MacLeod was interested in the history of science in the best possible way, and he was interested in it before I was. He wrote a lot of learned papers while he was in Sussex, and they were done in connection with Sprue. I'd like just to go on a bit more about the way in which science in my own life has figured since I left Sussex. I took a very big part in OECD discussions of science in Paris with a science research section which produced a very important study of interdisciplinarity. And I wrote a piece on Sussex in the book that they produced on interdisciplinarity, along with a French colleague of mine, Guy Michaud. And I learnt something of the comparative nature of my interest in science through Paris. I also then, at a later date, became interested in a group of people who were concerned with there, incidentally, is an annual report of Sprue for 1976, just after I left. And my successor as Vice Chancellor, Dennis Wilkinson, took as much of an interest in Sprue as I did. And it was Dennis who asked Brian Flowers to write a report on Sprue, which was very, very favourable indeed to the institution. But moving forward again, it's very, very dangerous to have pieces of paper around you, I realise that. And I've got one quite interesting one here, incidentally. I've used all kinds of things in thinking about this lecture tonight. I've got the University of Sussex Bulletin for February 1965. It was a publication intended for members of the University of Sussex, and at that time we had no publicity person involved with the affairs of the university, and the only person who kept good records of the early years throughout was my wife, who had two great scrapbooks of things about the first years. But the interesting point about this bulletin was that it was edited by Jack Lively, and Jack was a professor of politics. He was a reader in politics in this university. He subsequently became a professor elsewhere. And I was fascinated to see in it that there were art science films given in 1965. And it's interesting that the first one of them, given what I said about the motto of the university, was called The God Within. It was a film produced by the Nuffield Foundation. Cosmos was the second of the films that was shown. There's also a very interesting article in this copy of the bulletin on the first impressions of somebody who had come to Sussex to read, curiously enough, for a science degree. And that, I think, is itself makes this particular copy of the bulletin historically significant. Later on, I became interested through my work in Aspen in America in the work that was being done at Caltech. And I went to Caltech, and I was the only historian who spoke at the 75th anniversary celebrations at Caltech. And there I met Murray Gell-Mann, the famous physicist, who became a very close friend. And I can tell you that Murray was as remarkable a person as a involved in all subjects as anybody I've ever met. He was particularly interested in the history of coinage. His wife, in those days, was a historian. And Murray Gell-Mann used to talk to him about physics with as much interest as I'd ever talked to anybody else before. I've almost reached the climax of what I wish to say. I did take a very active part in a seminar, symposium probably is the best word for it, which was organised by a pharmaceutical organisation, which took place in Germany, and we were concerned with the way in which the sciences are related to each other. And the people taking part in that symposium included Alec Merrison, who had just written the report on the National Health Service, and Peter Medawar, a very, very remarkable man, who I've written about at some length in other places. And we talked there about the way that we thought that the sciences would influence the world in the future. Peter Alan Merrison became the Vice Chancellor of Bristol, and he was Vice Chancellor there when my son Daniel was a student at Bristol. I've reached the end of what I've got to say. When I've been contemplating it, I've realised that health sciences have played a very fundamental part in all my own work. It's not merely that I chaired a committee on nursing, but also that I have written more about the sciences in books about the health sciences in books from the very beginning of my academic life. The first lecture I ever gave was called Medicine and Science in the Age of Chadwick. And it was given to the Chadwick Trust. I later wrote a history of the Royal College of Physicians. And I realised that health links so much in my life together. And at that point, I will stop. And I'm sorry I've been a bit more halting than usual. The danger is I've got too much paper surrounding me. Thank you very much.